food, missile.
Excuse me, it's been a long day.
Minuteman III, Missile Combat Crew Commander, Vice Commander of the Air Force Global Strike Command, and most recently, Commander of the 20th Air Force Global Strike Command, and Commander of Task Force 214 at U.S. Strategic Command. So please welcome Lieutenant General Jack Weinstein to the stage.
Chris, thank you. I'm really excited to do this. Now, I do realize, though, that I am the last speaker of the day, which makes my position right now a little precarious, so I'm looking forward to talking to you. And I appreciate the opportunity with this broad cross-section of industry and government professionals supportive of our nation's defense. It's budget season here in Washington, and several of the previous panels discussed how we should grapple with what is commonly called the bow wave. I'm certainly willing to contribute to that discussion, but I'd like to use most of my time to address something more fundamental. Why we have these systems, why we need these systems, and highlight the value our deterrence force provides the citizens of our great nation and our allies. As the United States continues the long overdue modernization of its nuclear deterrent force, skeptics and opponents have become more vocal. Some arguments are based on emotions, others are based on the hope model, hoping that those countries modernizing their strategic arsenals will simply stop modernizing because we will. Simply, we cannot uninvent nuclear weapons. Looking into the foreseeable future, I am confident that Russia, China, and North Korea will maintain their nuclear weapons programs, develop new nuclear weapons, and or develop or upgrade their delivery systems. I'm sure you read an op-ed recently, several months ago, opposing the Obama administration's plan for the long-range standoff missile. Since the publication of that opinion piece, others have repeated those arguments and added some of their own. For example, several people have already refuted many of the assertions made by the LRSO opponents, and many arguments are in fact not actually LRSO-centric arguments. They are arguments simply opposed to nuclear modernization or nuclear weapons in general. But this debate provides a compelling example of the importance of remembering why we have a nuclear deterrent force in the first place. A recent opinion piece that argued that LRSO will be more capable than the air-launched cruise missile it replaces. From that, he deduced that LRSO is therefore designed for nuclear warfighting, a phrase meant to be sufficient to condemn the program outright, suggesting the true rationale for developing LRSO is to make it easier for the United States to use nuclear weapons. He then stated deterrence does not rely on warfighting capabilities. In doing so, he explicitly revives the pre-Cold War fallacy that nuclear warheads themselves make deterrence automatic. We all know that the goal of deterrence is to persuade potential adversaries that they gain no advantage from using or threatening to use nuclear weapons against the United States and our allies. Henry Kissinger succinctly noted that deterrence requires a combination of power, the will to use it, and the assessment of these by the potential aggressor. Moreover, deterrence is the product of those factors and not the sum. More, if any part is zero, deterrence fails.
Thank you.
Thus, deterrence requires more than warheads. The warfighting ability to employ nuclear weapons is the actual capability component critical to generating deterrence. The extent that warfighting capability is determined by what an adversary would find credible, because deterrence is not about influencing an adversary's decision-making. Another belief that has percolated for years is minimum deterrence, that a small number of survivable warheads are sufficient to generate deterrence. This is again another form of the deterrence and automatic argument. Survivable warheads may be necessary, but they are not sufficient to prevent nuclear coercion or nuclear use. The United States has consistently pursued strategic stability by developing and fielding a variety of complementary systems. These complementary capabilities are necessary to ensure would-be adversaries know the United States both has the capability and the will. I realize that tomorrow morning I'll read an article about this speech accusing me of being stuck in the Cold War. That is a theme that might seem like a catchy headline, but it is an emotional cliche without any merit. While the Triad is a legacy of the Cold War, it remains relevant to the threatened environment of today and the future. The Cold War was a conflict involving two major nation states. Today's security environment is complex, dynamic, and volatile, involving multiple nation states and non-state actors challenging the status quo. As Admiral Haney said, today's multipolar world is more akin to a multiplayer, concurrent, potentially intersecting games of chess, challenging regional and global security dynamics. This requires a comprehensive approach to strategic deterrence, assurance, and escalation control in the 21st century. What does today's strategic environment look like? On January 6, North Korea claimed to have tested a hydrogen bomb during what would be their fourth nuclear test. A month later, they defied a United Nations ban on testing ballistic missile technology by conducting a test launch of a multi-stage rocket. Last Tuesday, James Clapper, the Director of National Intelligence, provided his annual worldwide threat assessment to the Senate Armed Services Committee. In his remarks, he warned that North Korea's nuclear weapons and missile programs will continue to pose a serious threat to U.S. interest and to the security environment in East Asia. China continues to modernize their nuclear missile force, introducing road mobile systems as well as improving their silo-based systems. Director Clapper said, this new generation of missiles is intended to ensure the viability of China's strategic deterrent by providing a second strike capability. In addition, the Chinese People's Liberation Army Navy continues to develop the JL-2 submarine launch ballistic missile and might produce additional Jin-class nuclear-powered ballistic submarines, which would give China its first long-range, sea-based nuclear capability. These changes might bring observers to question the meaning of their current no-first-use policy. Russia has modernized its nuclear forces with new systems as it increases the number of its accountable warheads and delivery systems to reach the upper boundary of its New START limits. The United States has declared development of a ground-launched cruise missile is a violation of the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty. These modernization efforts, combined with their bellicose actions such as the annexation of Crimea and incursion into the sovereign nation of Ukraine, highlights that they have moved away from glasnost and perestroika. Referring to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, a member of the Ukrainian parliament said, we gave up nuclear weapons because of this agreement. Now there's a strong sentiment in Ukraine that we made a big mistake. He also said, if you have nuclear weapons, people don't invade you. While the recent Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action with Iran is progress, we need to evaluate Iran's strategic goals and any attempts to pursue nuclear weapons capabilities. As Director Clapper stated, Iran's political will is the central issue. Some argue that over the last 20 years, the world has become more complicated and more dangerous. I think we can agree that the world is complicated and dangerous enough, regardless of any time frame. Those of us who generate deterrence for this nation have been instructed to maintain strategic stability. We do that by providing a deterrent force that is both credible against direct threats and as a guarantee extended to our allies. The Air Force continues to assess how to best organize, train, and equip airmen to provide deterrence capabilities to meet the requirements of the combatant commanders and ultimately provide options for the President for a wide range of scenarios. What nuclear capabilities, then, do we need to retain or develop to meet our deterrence requirements? Do our investments fulfill those requirements? There is a strong tendency to want to focus on the numbers of nuclear weapons. But we're all aware that effective deterrence is more than numbers. Simply decreasing the number of warheads does not ensure a nation's safety and security. We must think critically about how lower numbers affect strategic stability and the credibility of extended deterrence. We must view our strategy through the perspective of potential adversaries and our allies. As the size of the nuclear arsenal decreases, Mitigating the risk of surprise and uncertainty remains important. One way to do that is with diversity in our warheads, delivery systems, and nuclear command and control communication systems. We also need to keep in mind the critical link between conventional and nuclear forces and a variety of regional scenarios. While the Triad may owe its existence to the dynamics of the late 1950s and early 1960s, it has been our chosen method of ensuring the diversity of capabilities needed to deter. The Triad still provides the best balance of attributes, even at significantly lower numbers. The United States Air Force is responsible for two legs of the nuclear triad, ICBMs and bombers, as well as dual-capable aircraft for NATO and many supporting components, like nuclear command and control communications, intelligence, surveillance and reconnaissance, space, and cyber. Our nuclear-capable bombers remain the most flexible and visible forces able to signal our nation's resolve and provide a tangible display of our ability to extend deterrence to allies. Bombers provide the widest range of deterrence options and weapons effects, including both direct attack and standoff capabilities. These scalable deep strike capabilities provide credible deterrent options, effective with multiple potential adversaries across a wide range of scenarios. These options are not only valuable during crises, but may be the only capabilities some adversaries find credible. These capabilities are critical to successful deterrence. Bombers not only represent the oldest type of a nuclear delivery system, the B-52 remains the oldest nuclear weapon system in our arsenal. Technological advances and improvements in air defenses will erode the credibility of our current bomber capabilities. We will counter this threat through modernization and recapitalization. The long-range strike bomber will ensure we maintain the capability to counter emerging threats. LRSB will provide the President with a power projection capability to hold targets at risk around the globe. It will sustain our ability to present that visible and flexible nuclear capability so important to extended deterrence. LRSB is being designed to have an open architecture, able to integrate new technology as the program matures. Agile acquisition processes have been built into the LRSB procurement program to ensure we obtain required system capabilities for the best value. The Intercontinental Ballistic Missile Force remains lethal and responsive. They hold a full range of high-value targets at risk with the lowest overall cost of any leg of the triad. The on-alert ICBM force establishes a very high threshold for an adversary, which encourages conflict resolution and denies an adversary's credible nuclear coercion options. For example, 50 ICBM silos create 50 targets, which must be destroyed to avoid a second strike. This obstacle alone significantly complicates a potential adversary's targeting calculus, contemplating an offensive nuclear course of action against the United States. The removal of the ICBM leg of the triad, as several op-eds proposed, would reduce the number of targets to neutralize this country's strategic capability to less than a dozen. Then, adversaries could focus investments in countering the remaining links of the triad and threaten the effectiveness of our entire force. The Minuteman III has been on alert since 1970. The ground-based strategic deterrent, as a follow-on to the Minuteman III, will maintain this critical capability for decades beyond 2030. The GBSD program is designed to improve performance while reducing sustainment costs. To reduce risk and decrease costs, the Air Force will pursue innovative approaches to identify and exploit commonality with the Navy. GBSD is on track to achieve a Milestone 8 decision later this year. As the nuclear enterprise ages, our approach to modernization will leverage recent technological advances and optimize operational agility. We will work to modernize legacy systems in order to provide credible and reliable capabilities to meet validated requirements. Modernization cannot be delayed further without putting the safety, security, and effectiveness of our nuclear forces at significant risk. As the Deputy Secretary of Defense said, the nuclear deterrence mission is the highest priority of the Department of Defense, and this mission must be resourced in accordance with that priority. Our modernization programs are not a choice between continuing current systems or modernizing. These modernization choices are a choice between modernization or losing deterrent capability. Lack of nuclear warfighting capability surrenders strategic maneuvering space or creates an escalation sanctuary to adversaries willing to run high risk during a crisis. Nuclear response capabilities across the entire spectrum of nuclear use are required to eliminate any adversary escalation sanctuary. In the President's budget for fiscal year 2017, released last week, the entire nuclear deterrent operation portfolio consisted of 5% of the total Air Force budget. Maintaining a credible and capable nuclear deterrent remains the top priority of the department. Overall, the President's budget includes $6.5 billion in fiscal year 17 and $38 billion over the next 5 years to sustain and modernize our deterrent force. The President's budget plans for $1.2 billion over the next 5 years for NC3 modernization to ensure that our command and control systems are protected against the proliferation of cyber attacks. The President's budget includes $63 million to upgrade the secure communications capability for the B-2 and $220 million to provide upgrades to the B-52 to modernize its radar and ensure that these aircraft will benefit from commonality to completely integrate with the joint force. These modernization efforts do not increase the probability of nuclear war. Only the President can authorize the use of nuclear weapons. These investments play a crucial role in being able to provide a credible deterrent force. Modernizing our systems are only one part of the equation to ensure a strong deterrent force. Developing and educating our airmen is just as important. The Air Force was born out of bold, innovative thinkers. Leaders like Billy Mitchell envisioned the advantages of going over and not through enemy lines to achieve military objectives. Often hierarchical organizations resist innovation, as in the case of Billy Mitchell, because they challenge the assumptions and beliefs, or simply the mantra, "That's the way we've always done it." One of the most significant ways we grow leaders in the nuclear enterprise is through professional development opportunities. Officers, non-commissioned officers, and civilians receive continuing education through Air University's Nuclear 200, 300, and 400 series of courses. Nuclear-specific intermediate and senior development education fellowships are available for officers and civilians at the National Laboratories, Department of Energy, RAND Corporation, think tanks, and top-tier universities. No one in this room knows what the future will hold. But the last 5,000 years of history has shown us that we will continue to face enemies, and there will continue to be people who wish to do us harm. We must have a deterrent force that is flexible so we can respond to the unexpected. The three legs of the U.S. nuclear triad, nuclear command control communications, supporting infrastructure, space and early warning sensors, and ballistic missile defenses are critical components of our strategic deterrent force that provide unique and complementary capabilities that deter an adversary and assure our allies and partners. The legs of the triad are not redundant. They are complementary and provide significantly different attributes across the spectrum of conflict. Together, the legs of the triad provide synergistic effects where the resultant deterrent effects are greater than the sum of the parts. The resulting deterrent effect is why we developed the triad in the first place. Our strategic weapons have already been used decades beyond their originally intended service life. Modernization and warhead life extension programs improve confidence in the reliability and capability of your system. The ICBM force provides the most rapid response capability. Maintaining an effective air-delivered standoff and penetrating capability is vital to meeting our deterrence and assurance commitments while denying sanctuaries for potential adversaries. Ballistic missile submarines provide maximum survivability and second strike capability. In our current fiscal environment, we must make difficult decisions about our priorities. 21st century deterrence and assurance will demand persistent and focused efforts. Our investments are not simply in weapons, but also in professional airmen conducting nuclear deterrence operations every single day. Nuclear deterrence provides the foundation to our national security strategy. I'm glad that we can have this dialogue in the United States. I guarantee you that we will not see these types of discussions or this level of transparency in Moscow, Beijing, or Pyongyang. Thank God we have the freedom and democracy here in the United States. That is why I'm proud to wear this uniform and serve our country every day. We continue to be the best Air Force in the world because of our airmen and the families serving alongside them. We will support and defend the ideals of the Constitution for our families and for our nation. Thank you. Wow. I'd love to ask questions.
Don't answer any questions.
I'll answer some questions.
Any questions for the general?
What happens when it's the end of the day? This is good. Peter.
Yes, sir. Could you address some of the misconceptions you referenced with respect to the long-range strike option, both the bomber itself as well as the cruise missile?
Yeah, I think there's been comments that were made that talked about that it's a destabilizing capability. But those are the same people that aren't making comments about the air-launched cruise missile and the capability that provided by the air-launched cruise missile, nor the Hondar missile that was used before that. So I disagree with that basic premise that it's a destabilizing capability. The combat commander has a warfighting requirement to ensure that there are no sanctuaries on the planet so that people can hide, so it's important for us to have a capability. It goes back to what Henry Kissinger said. Having warheads isn't enough. What you need is the capability and the will that the adversary sees. Therefore, when you have a nuclear warfighting capability, it's actually based on systems, delivery systems, proper training, people, ranges, communications, so the adversary knows that if we get to that level, that the United States can respond. The LRSO provides that as a standoff capability, as well as a new bomber provides those capabilities that are in highly defended areas that we know are going to get more highly defended as years go by. It goes into the overall deterrence capability of what we're trying to modernize in the Department of Defense. And I wanted to be really clear, and Peter, I want to go into a kind of a little bit more discussion. That's why I want to be really clear. I stand up here as an airman defending why we need a new bomber, why we need a new land-based ballistic missile, and why we need weapons that provide us the capability to do that. I also stand up here as an airman defending the ballistic missile force for the United States Navy because that leg of the triad is extremely critical to what this country provides. So when I look at some of the comments that people have made on the platforms, I don't believe that they're comments directly against the platforms. They're comments against anything that is modernizing the nuclear force. And that's where the arguments go against. One thing I try to be clear about is we need to look at this, the world and what the eyes were looking at. When you look at other nations completely modernizing their nuclear forces, remember they're modernizing their nuclear forces when what we have is a bomber developed in the 1950s and an ICBM that was developed in the 1960s. And when you look at our systems that are going to be coming online, they're going to be coming online in the mid-20s is when that's going to happen. So obviously we need to look at some of these issues through the eyes of other nations on what they're doing. And I firmly believe that those other nations are not going to be getting rid of their nuclear weapons anytime soon.
Thank you.
I would imagine that table would have a question.
Good afternoon, General.
Good afternoon, Bill.
Bill Hughes with Lockheed Martin. You mentioned in your comments GBSD and the advantages to look at Air Force and Navy commonality. There are a lot of different definitions about that. Could you share your perspective on that and maybe how you define or what you see commonality would look like in that area?
Yeah, just to be clear, it's not my definition of commonality. It's the commonality we've been working as a team between ourselves and Admiral Benedict and SSP. As a matter of fact, I had a commonality meeting 2 hours ago with Admiral Benedict talking about the same thing. We're not looking at putting D5 ashore, and there is some talk about that. But there are some systems and subsystems that have been developed that are nuclear certified that could be used into a GBSD as we share components back and forth. We talked about the bow wave, so we know, and the bow wave just isn't on nuclear systems. There's a bow wave in the Department of Defense on modernizing what we do modernized. So I think by developing a close relationship with the United States Navy, both at the component level, the subcomponents, the subsystems level, and we can share those back and forth, we help in the development of GBSD, and we help the Navy as they try, as they sustain the D5 in the future.
General, this one.
Some of us were at a conference in 2004. Robert McNamara was there, and he said that he very privately advised President Kennedy, President Johnson, that they should never, under any circumstances, ever use a nuclear weapon. They went for a little walk outside, had that conversation. Now, he didn't say, tell the world about that, but that's what he said. You know, it's hard for a country that is so powerful, that dominates the world in many ways, in its military spending, in its overseas bases. We've enjoyed for a long time a degree of not exactly hegemony, but tremendous influence around the world. Countries that have followed this trajectory in the past have often been blindsided by weaknesses that didn't fit within the paradigm that they were used to thinking of. This could happen to us. And I just wanted to comment that I don't think that we do or can control the escalatory ladder everywhere around the world at all times with all the actors that we have made arrangements with. We may try, and I know it's your job to do that, but the other people around the world, the world is a very complicated place, and providing capabilities which threaten may result in asymmetric responses that we can't really control. And it's those threats to others which amplify the threats against ourselves very often. And they may come in ways that we can't afford, we can't defend against.
In 1983, I attended ICBM school at Vandenberg. And when I attended that school and I learned how to operate the Minuteman III weapon system, I did so not to destroy another country, I did so in order to protect my country. I firmly believe that to this day. As someone who has a family and children and a wife and a mother and father, I don't want them to be used either. In that same token, I believe I have an obligation when I wear this uniform to ensure that we protect this country, to keep it the way it is. I had an individual tell me, and publicly I have said, I think I said it first on ABC News, and it was quoted on 60 Minutes, that I sleep well at night knowing that we have a nuclear deterrent force. And I sleep well at night based on how they were designed, and I sleep well at night based on the airmen and the sailors that are operating them. Individual looked at me and said, no, I disagree, I don't sleep well at night because you have nuclear weapons. And I said, well, that's an opinion you can have. I said, but I think you'd sleep a lot worse if only the Russians, the Chinese, and the North Koreans had them. You can't reinvent nuclear weapons, but what we can do is ensure that we have a deterrent force that protects this nation so that no one will use it against this nation or our allies. Okay, it's a minute and 20 seconds.
I'm wondering if you have given some thought or discussing within the Pentagon ways in which the United States might, in the near term, alter its declaratory policy, be publicly more transparent in some ways to increase stability. That is the objective. Thank you.
Not for what I do on a day-to-day basis. Good question to talk to the policy folks, but no. Not really in my job right now. Okay, Chris. All right, thank you, everybody. Yep.